You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on the programme, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, son of the late dictator and former darling of the West, will go on trial next month. We'll see what this means for the future of Libya. Tomorrow, Norwegian courts will deliver a verdict on the Anders Behring Breivik case. Where does the country go from here?
It's being debated that how much do we want to give of our open democracy? How much do we want to close off roads? How much do we want police with guns in the streets? So I think there will be still time for reflection even after tomorrow's verdict.
With the boom in private helicopters in Brazil, how close are they to building one completely in the country?
We need to build even more, to gain even more technology for our company, and we are going to do it.
And a new yodeling scheme, seriously, is having some Austrian hikers singing. It's not a proper show if there's not any yodeling. A little bit later as well, Hugo MacDonald will be in to tell us what's caught his eye in the world of design this week. All that is coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. But before any of that, let's catch up on the news headlines from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
The lawyer for self-confessed Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik has said today that her client will appeal if a court decides he's insane. The verdict will be announced tomorrow, more than a year since the day Breivik killed 77 people. Vibeke Hen Behra met her client for a final briefing.
Today we had this meeting with him here at Ila prison discussing tomorrow's verdict and what he can do, whether the judges will come to the one conclusion or the other. What he says is that if the judges find him not sane and mentally disturbed, he will appeal. If the judges will sentence him to punishment, and mentally sane, he says today, as we understand him, that he will not appeal.
Well, business surveys today have painted a picture of economic malaise stretching from Beijing to Berlin, adding to concerns that the world economy is slowing down. The 17-country eurozone appears to be heading for its second recession in 3 years. Financial data firm Markit said the eurozone economy will shrink by 0.5% in the July to September quarter. Europe's problems are creating headaches in other economies as well, particularly China's, which counts Europe as its single biggest export market. Florida state officials say they're closely monitoring Tropical Storm Isaac's path as the state prepares to host the Republican National Convention in Tampa. Governor Rick Scott said today he was confident the state was prepared to deal with a hurricane, but said the decision to move the four-day convention would be made by the Republican Party.
This state's prepared. I mean, we've gone through hurricanes. We have great local emergency teams. We've got great state emergency teams. So depending on what happens, if we have a hurricane, where it's going to hit in the state, we'll deal with it. That's what we do as a state. We've had hurricanes in the past, and we've done a great job.
Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, will go on trial next month, a government source has said today, in the most high-profile prosecution of a figure from the fallen regime. He will have to respond to charges which include financial corruption, murder and rape, according to a statement from Libya's Justice Minister, Ali Ashour. Saif al-Islam's lawyers have voiced concern that their client, viewed by many Libyans as a central power figure in the Gaddafi regime, will not get a fair trial in Libya. Nigeria's capital city Abuja is suffering severe fuel shortages after a trade union halted deliveries and threatened to cut supplies to the rest of the country by Friday unless the government resumes some subsidy payments it has withheld. The country's finance minister, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, says the government will not pay fuel subsidies to importers currently being investigated for fraud.
To have this hold on the nation by saying that they are not importing fuel and they are not going to sell. But we are not going to give in to that. What we have decided to do is that we will look again at some of those who are not participating in this and who may have maybe a slight infraction and talk to them.
And finally, a Nepali man who was bitten by a cobra snake bit it back and killed the reptile in a tit-for-tat attack, a newspaper said today. Nepali Daily Annapurna Post said Mohammed Salmomia chased the snake, which bit him in his rice paddy, caught it and bit it until it died. Once bitten, certainly not twice shy. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Bit him in his rice paddy. Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. It is 21:05 in Moscow, 18:05 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Out London, tu vas à Monocle 24.
De Londres, vous écoutez Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London から
From London
Monocle 24 です
This is Monocle 24
Desde Londres Esto es Monocle 24
Vanuit London This is Monocle 24
From London
This is Monocle 24
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. In a daily media landscape saturated with reports from the battle over Syria, other members of the Arab Uprising Club are often overlooked. The slow fall of the late Colonel Muammar Gaddafi last year at the hands of rebels backed by NATO once dominated the headlines. Now, a Libyan prosecutor has announced that Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the dictator's son, and it's fair to say a former darling of the West, or certainly certain Western leaders, will go on trial in September, next month. Saif al-Islam, once the presumed heir to the regime, has stated his desire to be tried at the International Criminal Court, where he would not face the death penalty. Understandable. His fate following the trial in Zintan, where he is currently being held, would almost certainly be less kind. Joining us now is David Schenker, the director of the programme on Arab politics for the Washington Institute in Washington, D.C. David, thank you very much for joining us. Let's start with some basics here. Why does the ICC want to put him on trial in The Hague rather than in Libya?
Well, there's several reasons, really, but I think primarily in terms of these transitional justice issues and for war crimes and war against crimes against humanity, they typically like to do these things. The other reason is maybe more particular to Libya, which is that there is very little confidence that Saif Islam could possibly get a fair trial in Libya, and particularly in Misrata, where he's currently being held. Not only is the Libyan judiciary most likely not up to the task. There's some question about the partiality, about whether he'd be able to get even a fair trial among his peers.
But, I mean, when you look at the ways that the ICC is allowed to intervene in cases, I mean, there's three ways. One is if a state itself says, we can't deal with this, which is, you know, the case of Joseph Kony and some of the warlords in Congo. The Libyans are saying, no, don't worry, we can deal with this. Another is if the Security Council tells them to investigate, and the Security Council hasn't. So, I mean, on what grounds can the ICC turn around to Libya, a sovereign state, and say, we want to interfere in the way you're doing your justice?
Well, I didn't even know that Libya was a signatory to the International Criminal Court. But listen, I think it would be United Nations pressure, but this, too, is a fairly divisive issue. The United States is not a supporter of the International Criminal Court, and so even within the United Nations, the organization has its supporters and its detractors. I think the main point, though, is that there's a broad, I think, international consensus that Libya is just not up to the task. I mean, even people like Ahmed Sanusi, who spent, I think, more years in prison as a political prisoner under Gaddafi than Nelson Mandela in South Africa, has come out on the record and saying, no, you know, we've got to get Gaddafi out of the country because in terms of forensics, in terms of all the other, evidentiary issues, this country just cannot perform at that level right now. But I don't know what kind of pressure can be can be brought to bear to force Libya to give him up. I mean, this is now a domestic hot potato political issue. The Misratins want Gaddafi to hang, and they won't even let him out of their town for fear that he may not hang if he goes somewhere else.
When we look at other similar cases, obviously in Iraq, there was the trial and then subsequent execution of Saddam Hussein, which I think it's arguable perhaps wasn't great for tribal relations within Iraq. Do you worry that if this trial is not free and fair and Saif al-Islam Gaddafi is executed, that that could have a real effect on situations of war and peace inside Libya?
Well, I think that there are many people who are concerned about that. I think that's a legitimate concern. You're already seeing some bombings in Libya, I think. And many people are saying among these tribes that if in fact he is hung or believed to have not gotten a fair trial, that the tribes that that still support the Gaddafis will take vengeance. And I think this could get very ugly very quick. Likewise, even if he's convicted but not given the death penalty, you'll have the Misratins. We have to remember what a tribal society this is. Even after Gaddafi, in the current government, you had the Minister of Defense appointed from one tribe, the Misratins, and another from the Zintanians for the Chief of Defense. It is being given out according to tribal allocations. This is a factor that predominates, I think, the thinking and the culture, for better or for worse, and it's going to have an impact, just like it had an impact when Saddam was executed in Iraq.
Well, you mentioned that the position of Chief of Defense that the that Zintan claims or has, I mean, they essentially extracted that anyway from holding Saif al-Islam. They said, if you guys don't give us some sort of good government post, we won't hand him over. They got the government post and they then didn't hand him over. I mean, this seems to highlight, enormous issues that are still unresolved within Libya, despite the fact there is a new government. How can those issues begin to be solved?
Well, this is going to take years, I think, ultimately. Libya is a broken society, right? Gaddafi took a toll. When you have a dictator that guts, the political system, that instills and accentuates tribalism, it's going to, I think, undermine the fabric of society. And there's just no tradition of governance any other way in Libya right now. And so it's going to have to be built over time. But in Libya, it's particularly difficult because these tribes, as probably other countries are learning in Afghanistan, et cetera, don't want to give up their perquisites. And so you end up, as a government, having to pay off tribes with positions, patronage, perhaps even the trial of your leading, war criminal in this town. It's not going to push the society forward in terms of progress or building a new Libya if it happens like this. But it's, I think, reflects the tribal nature of society and the exigencies of politics on the ground right now, unfortunately.
David Schenker, Director of the Programme on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
For this week's episode of Section D, we hopped over to Sweden for a Stockholm Fashion Week special. We sit down with Benaz Aram, one of the city's most feted designers, to find out about the Swedish consumer. And we drop in on Bauer, Scandinavia's oldest surviving tailor, enjoying a new lease of life. And Byredo fragrance founder Ben Gorham tells us why he swapped basketballs for perfume bottles too.
I'd asked the perfumer to help me translate a few specific memories into smells. And that's where the interest grew into an obsession, and where I realized that I had to create a business to be able to do this full time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House. It's 18:15 here in London, 10:15 a.m. in Seattle. Australia has managed to resist the ravages of recent global market turmoil, aided by a booming natural resources sector, which has kept investment pouring in and the economy in robust health. But there are increasing signs that this boom may be coming to an end. No better illustrated than by the country's resources minister, Martin Ferguson, who yesterday issued a stark warning. Many big Australian players are now struggling in the face of competition from the Middle Eastern and Chinese airlines. Qantas reported its first annual loss since the airline was privatised 17 years ago. And mining giant BHP Billiton has cancelled $40 billion worth of expansion. So where does this leave the Australian economy? Joining us now is Simon Baptist, principal at Vivid Economics. Simon, let's start with this first point from Martin Ferguson, the resources minister. Has the boom actually come to an end?
Hi there, nice to be on the show. Has the boom come to an end? I think in some ways the dichotomy that was set up by the minister about whether the boom is either over or not over is a little bit false. Commodities always go up and down in price. I mean, commodity cycles have been going on for as long as people have been buying and selling commodities, and there's no doubt that for the last few years commodity prices have been very high. That's been a great thing for Australia. At some point in the future, you know, prices will fall. I mean, we have seen fairly large falls over the last 6 months. Anyone who's able to predict the exact end or beginning of a boom or bust in minerals prices would end up becoming a very wealthy person. But Australia does have to prepare for the day when it doesn't have high mineral prices like it does today.
I mean, there's an argument, though, as well, that, you know, high mineral prices has also extracted quite a high price on Australian society. I mean, you know, you've seen house prices shoot up. You've seen lots of other industries suffer because they can't, get the right calibre of people. If you can get a $200,000 a year job driving a truck straight out of high school, what's the point of going to university?
So, I mean, the high prices for minerals and has led to a lot of capital and a lot of workers shifting into the resource sector, which, as you say, has had an impact on the rest of the economy. Another large impact has been through the appreciation of the Australian dollar, which means some industries that are also very important for Australia, like education and tourism and agricultural products and manufactured goods, are all facing tougher competitive positions in the international market because of the appreciating exchange rate. But in the past, commodity prices have been very low in Australia, I mean in the world, and that's had an impact on Australia. In the 1990s, commodity prices were low and the mining sector was growing much less than the rest of the Australian economy. For the last few years, that situation has been reversed. It's no surprise for the Australian economy that it is exposed to these price cycles, and the question really is managing the economy so that you make the most of the good times as far as resources go to prepare you for the bad times.
I mean, is that what has actually happened? Do you have the feeling that the Australian government over the last few years has recognised that this can't go on forever and we need to make sure we're investing in other things like new technology, like education, to ensure that, when the tap is turned off, we're still all right?
The record has been mixed. There have been some really good uses that the revenue has been put to. I mean, for example, a couple of years ago, Australia basically paid off its entire national debt, which is the situation, of course, over here in Europe.
We wouldn't mind being able to do that.
So, I mean, that was a good use of the high revenues. There have also been a number of tax reforms, recent introduction of the carbon tax and also a change in the way that minerals are taxed. The government has used most of the revenue from that to reduce income taxes, whereby the tax-free allowance that Australians has tripled this year. It's gone from $6,000 to about $18,000 a year. So that's having a big impact on reducing the cost of labour, which will be of assistance to those industries that are, you know, are less polluting and less intensive in the use of carbon and more labour intensive. So there have been some reforms. But on the other hand, Australia has a lower share of investment percentage of its GDP investing in education, both at the secondary and the tertiary level, than many other countries in the OECD. And there also tends to have been a lower rate of investment in infrastructure than in some other comparable economies. And so it's not all good news, but it is a mixed picture.
Simon Baptist at Vivid Economics, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're going to be heading to Oslo shortly, but we're going to stay in Australia right now. This is Daniel Merriweather with Impossible. That was Daniel Merriweather with Impossible.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24. Hong Kong, Zurich,
London.
Londres. Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monaco, 24.
From London.
In London.
London, Cara.
De Londres.
This is Monaco 24.
Two attacks by one man left 77 people dead just over 1 year ago. The Anders Behring Breivik murders were the worst attacks sustained by Norway since the Second World War. Two locations were the scene for these tragic events: a government building in Oslo, where 8 people were killed in an explosion, and Utøya Island, where Breivik gunned down 69 young people attending a summer camp. Tomorrow, a third location will hold the nation's attention, as after a lengthy trial, the courts will deliver the verdict to hopefully close this chapter of Norway's recent history. To discuss where Norway will go from now, we were joined earlier by Lars Bevanger, who had been covering the trial from the beginning. I began by asking Lars if the sense of unity that existed within the country after the attacks still exists.
I think it does. I was here to cover the first anniversary events of the attacks, and people again came out in their thousands to commemorate and also again to voice their support for what the Prime Minister said already in the hours after the attacks last year, that these attacks should not change this open society and the democracy of Norway. However, since then, there has been an independent commission report looking into how the attacks were dealt with by emergency services and politicians. And that was very scathing in its criticism, particularly of the police, but also of some of the political leadership for not having taken enough preventative measures, for instance, closing off road access to the government headquarters, which meant that Breivik was allowed to drive his massive car bomb all the way up to the Prime Minister's front door. There's been a bit of a witch hunt, if you like, in the media, particularly since that report, with calls for various leaders to go, and the National Police Chief indeed had to step down after that criticism. But again, I think people are coming around to this idea that, at least it's being debated, that how much do we want to give of our open democracy? How much do we want to close off roads? How much do we want police with guns in the streets? So I think there will be still time for reflection even after tomorrow's verdict.
You mentioned those changes that people are a little wary of. I mean, after attacks elsewhere in the world, there have been changes. In the UK, Tony Blair, after the attacks of 7th of July 2005 said the rules of the game have changed and suggests a number of things that should change. In the US, obviously, after September 11th, there was the setting up of the Department of Homeland Security. There were all sorts of other security changes there. In Norway, do you think it's possible that you can get through this without making those sorts of changes that have happened elsewhere? Is there still that sense that, you know, we must carry on as we were?
There's going to have to be some changes, but I think there'll be less visible ones. And I think, for instance, there'll be a considerable reorganisation of the police and other emergency services, how they communicate, for instance, who gives the orders, who takes charge in an extreme situation like this country experienced on the 22nd of July last year. What I don't think we'll see is a lot of roadblocks, physical barriers for people's access to politicians, things like this. They will probably close off the street behind the government headquarters, which allowed Breivik to park his car bomb there. That is bound to happen. But beyond that, I don't think people will see much physical evidence of change. But I think most people there expect something to happen. Something clearly has to change to allow for the police in particular to prevent any future terrorist action.
Politically, have there been many changes in terms of people's views on migration, immigration? Although Breivik was obviously far, far more extreme than anyone else in Norway, there had been a growing feeling among the right that there was too much migration, that Norway had sort of lost itself in some way. Has that changed at all over the past year or so?
It has changed a little bit in that when people are arguing against immigration, and people still are, they tend to be particularly careful not to sound like they are spouting the same views or even close to spouting the same views as Breivik has. Having said that, the centre-right opposition, the Populist Progress Party, are still riding relatively high in opinion polls. They did fall immediately after the attacks. They've bounced back. There will be parliamentary elections next year, and they're expected to do well, as they usually do. And immigration is, there's quite tight regulation of immigration in Norway already. It's been for quite a few years. But I do think people have got their eyes open, and opinion polls have shown that most people have become slightly more positive to immigrants who are already here from the non-Western countries. But the views of whether Norway should accept more or relax their immigration laws or keep them as they are, I don't think those views have changed noticeably.
And Lars, just one final thing about the verdict itself and what happens afterwards. Obviously, Norway doesn't have the death penalty. The most he can get is 21 years in jail, although that can sort of be extended, I understand. Has there been any concern about that at all? Is there any sort of broad movement to say, look, this isn't a powerful enough penalty?
No, I think most people realise that he can be kept locked up indefinitely, be it in prison or in a psychiatric institution. The law allows for this. You're right in saying that the strictest prison sentence is 21 years, but after that, if a person is deemed to still be a danger to society, that can be extended. Whereas if he is sentenced to psychiatric care, he obviously will be kept there until he's deemed cured, if you like. And even then, it's uncertain whether he would actually be released into society, because there is also legislation which would allow him to then be transferred to the prison system, again, if he's still considered to be too dangerous to be released.
That was Lars Bavanger talking to me a little bit earlier, all about tomorrow's Anders Behring Breivik verdict. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll chat with our design editor, Hugo MacDonald. We'll hear about the private helicopter industry in Brazil. And yes, I think we'll also do a little bit of yodeling.
Hopes to your E3, I hopes to your E-ho. Hopes to your E3, I hopes to your E-ho.
But first, here's a yodel-free Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. World business surveys today have painted a picture of economic malaise stretching from Beijing to Berlin, adding to concerns that the world economy is slowing down. The 17-country Eurozone appears to be heading for its second recession in 3 years, with predictions it will shrink by 0.5% in the July to September quarter. The lawyer for self-confessed Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik has said today that her client will appeal if a court decides he's insane. The verdict will be announced tomorrow, more than a year since he killed 77 people in Oslo. Florida state officials say they're closely monitoring Tropical Storm Isaac's path as the state prepares to host the Republican National Convention in Tampa. Governor Rick Scott said the decision to move the four-day convention would be made by the Republican Party. In Libya, Muammar Gaddafi's son Saif al-Islam will go on trial next month in the most high-profile prosecution of a figure from the fallen regime. Saif al-Islam's lawyers have voiced concern that their client, viewed by many Libyans as a central power figure in that Gaddafi regime, will not get a fair trial in Libya. And Nigeria's capital city, Abuja, is suffering severe fuel shortages after a trade union halted deliveries and threatened to cut supplies to the rest of the country by Friday unless the government resumes some subsidy payments it has withheld. But the country's finance minister says the government will not pay those subsidies to importers currently being investigated for fraud. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Now, at the moment, we are putting the finishing touches, the almost finishing touches, to the October issue of Monocle. And I think it's fair to say, it's got a Lusophone theme, a loose Lusophone theme. Currently, we have editors in Mozambique, in Brazil, and even the Azores. And several Monocle editors, including myself and our next guest, Hugo MacDonald, were in Portugal earlier this week. Now, I was on Midori House on Tuesday night explaining all about my trip to Portugal. Hugo, you haven't had a chance to explain all about yours yet.
No, I haven't. I hope you didn't ruin the surprise of what I was hoping to talk about, though, when you came in.
Ooh, well, now I'm not entirely sure what you want to talk about. But tell us a little bit about... Well, we went to Lisbon
we
together.
We did. It was
and then I
my
stayed
first,
in Lisbon, yeah, but you moved on.
I moved on. And this was my first trip to Portugal ever. Surprisingly, given how fashionable Lisbon is as a holiday destination nowadays, and Portugal itself as well, has obviously been a very... well, sort of a regular holiday destination for people across Europe since the 80s. But driving into Lisbon from the airport, we were both struck by the tiled buildings, which
yes,
to anybody who's been to Lisbon, they'll know exactly what we're talking about. They're called the Azulejos de Lisboa. And they have been, many of the buildings have been tiled for centuries, right back until the 15th century was when they started, when they came up through, via the Moors, through the Arab world to Portugal.
And it's incredible to look at because they go all the way up to the top. You have entire facades covered in hundreds and hundreds of tiles, almost all of them handmade. In fact, still handmade.
Very few of them are obviously the original ones from the late 15th, early 16th century. Most of those were went away in the 1755 earthquake, of course. But the Portuguese have really adopted them. And the population of Lisbon has maintained that having tiles on the front of the building and also on the insides of a lot of the buildings keeps them free from rot. And it's also very hygienic and easy to clean, which is why sort of butchers, long before hand wash or antibacterial spray or good old Detox wipes, would have tiles in their butchers. So they were easy to wash down.
It's interesting how even modern office buildings that we saw that had just been built were, again, covered in tiles. Theirs were a little more boring, a little more basic.
But maybe boring to you, but to me they were very nice because they weren't just a pastiche of the old sort of decorative tiles from sort of Sunni Islamic era or rather sort of sect. And they weren't really the sort of Chinese imported ones, which were very sort of blue and white foliage that were very popular in the 18th century. They're plain, but they have a texture, a subtle texture. And I quite like the fact that these tile manufacturers, some of whom are still working in the city, many of whom are working throughout Portugal, are putting their own stamp on it rather than just rehashing what's been before.
Now, you didn't stick around in Lisbon for long. We had one night out.
We had a lovely dinner.
We did.
And
we did.
A stroll through some of the old city. But then I hot-footed it the next morning down to an area called Comporta, which is probably, without exaggerating, one of the last stretches of unspoiled beaches in Europe. It is...
How long?
It's 56 kilometres long.
Wow.
It's very, very long. And when you're standing on it and you just see this stretch of white sand going into the distance with pinpricks of maybe three or four people, you realise actually how rare it is to stand on a beach that has not got some form of development on it.
And how has that happened? How has it stayed relatively development-free?
Well, I'm not going to give the entire story
away. No, sure.
It's something to do with the fact that it's in the Portuguese government has very wisely slapped a whole load of restrictions on what can happen there. Because
that's quite unusual, though, isn't it?
It's very unusual, but this is one of the highest migratory paths for birds in the world. And so sort of ecologists and wildlife, how would you describe them? I don't want to say fans, because obviously people who let the WWF have gone in and said, okay, this is an area of land that cannot be built on.
Environmental activists,
there you go. They have put these heavy restrictions on, which have totally been observed by everybody who lives there. And there is no building on that beach for 56 kilometres. There's a couple of restaurants just behind these high dunes which separate, where you can marginally develop areas, but still they're hidden from the beach. And you then go into the deltas and some natural marshes, some of which have been turned into rice fields. Again, very popular with birds migrating. And it means that there are just these tiny little pockets of very traditional forms of life where people have been sort of tending to the rice fields or fishing that have not been able to grow and have been sort of pretty much left as they have been for centuries.
And yet now...
The worst mosquitoes I've ever come across in my life.
Poor you. And yet now there is a little bit of development that's starting, isn't there?
There's a move by one of the families that owns it that 1% of the area of land that they own, they are going to very tastefully start building on it to open the area up, provide some more sort of stable economic opportunities to the people who do live there. And sort of grow it, but grow it very tastefully and sensitively, and definitely not going anywhere near building on the beach.
No, or five-star resorts. How difficult is it to do that sort of development carefully, particularly when, even if you don't really care personally about the area, the natural beauty of the area is part of the thing that sells. And so you have to make sure that it looks good and it fits in. How difficult can that be to get right?
It's very difficult. And all anybody would say is go and see the Algarve further down the coast, see how it's been done wrong. People want to squeeze these areas for as much as they can get. And I think the family that's in charge of this stretch of land is so very wary of the pitfalls of that, and hence trying to do it quite carefully, employing only three architects, very carefully monitoring the type of sort of houses and type of furnishings and the type of materials that are used to make sure that what they do build fits in seamlessly with what exists already and with the natural landscape. And also, we're talking maybe 150, 200 houses maximum. Mm. It's not going to be 16-storey apartment blocks and endless hotels. It's sort of tasteful, very small, slow developments. And that's what I was looking at.
And we can see just how tastefully it has been done and how carefully it needs to be done in the next issue of Monocle, which is out, middle of September, isn't it?
October, just under a month from now.
Lovely. Hugo, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Approaching the station. The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers, and politicians changing the urban world. In this episode of The Urbanist, you're going to need some comfortable shoes because we're going to be doing a lot of walking. From Copenhagen to Auckland, we go to roam streets, pathways, and public spaces that put those on 2 feet first. We're going to start in London on Exhibition Road, which is attempting to reinvent how you split up street space. In Copenhagen, we're going to check in with Gael Architects. And in New York, our bureau chief is going to soak up some summer sun while standing smack dab in the middle of Park Avenue.
The picturesque and often congested Park Avenue is closed to cars from Central Park all the way down to Brooklyn Bridge to allow New Yorkers to run, cycle, or walk their way down their built-up city.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you don't have to wait long for that episode of The Urbanist because it's coming in 18 minutes. But at the moment, you're listening to Midori House, and this is Two Door Cinema Club with Something Good Can Work. From Northern Ireland and via the Friends of Monocle label Kitsune, that was Two Door Cinema Club with Something Good Can Work. It is 1845 here in London. A boom in the private helicopter industry is taking flight in Brazil. At the recent Latin America Business Aviation Conference and Exhibition, it's a long title, isn't it? In Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo, over 1,600 helicopters were on show for a cluster of potential buyers. And with more private heliports looking to be developed within the next year to house these aircraft, along with local regional helicopter manufacturer Helibras looking to create a 100% Brazilian-produced helicopter, the industry doesn't look like it will be grounded anytime soon. Can you see what we did there? Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter was at the trade show to find out more.
Helicopter blades rapidly whip around high in the Sao Paulo sky. It's the constant buzz of the comings and goings of the city's elite as they speed to their next destination, with a time-is-money mentality. Unable to lose precious minutes in some of the world's worst traffic jams on Sao Paulo streets. But down here on the ground at Sao Paulo City Airport, Congonhas, the hustle and bustle that helicopters bring to the city are fueling a whole industry in Brazil.
General aviation is the best tool you can have to develop your business.
That was Rodrigo Duarte, president of ABRAPI, the Brazilian Helicopters Pilots Association, pointing out that aviation is now a big part of business development here. And here at the 9th Annual Latin American Business Aviation Conference and Exhibition, this is evident. The over 15,000 attendees at the three-day event circle around, browsing at new potential investments from private jets to helicopters to the byproducts of heavy growth in the area, like more private heliports, one of which will be built within the next 10 months. Something much needed in Brazil, explains Mr. Duarte.
Because helicopter flying here in Brazil and São Paulo city are growing up so fast that we do not have much more space to park the helicopters.
Brazil is a very important market.
Many agree with Mr. Duarte, like Peter Ingleton from the International Business Aviation Council, who has come over from the UK for the event. In fact, Sao Paulo is now home to the world's biggest helicopter fleet, with around 500 registered helicopters taking 700 flights per day, most of them privately owned. More private heliports need to be built to ease up traffic, says Mr. Ingleton.
It should certainly help because Congonhas has been increasingly congested airport, and there's probably much more demand now for business aviation than can be accommodated at Congonhas. So there really is a desperate need for another airport, a new airport dedicated to business aviation. This will be a very, very significant development, not only for Sao Paulo, but for Brazil as well.
One company that is looking to fill these new heliports with its aircraft is Helibras, the Brazilian arm of the French-based helicopter company Eurocopter. Helibras is the only company that produces helicopters not only in Brazil, but across Latin America. But of course, with the help of importing some helicopter parts from Europe, the demand for helicopters has helped the producer go nowhere but up. Along with signing a contract with the Brazilian government to deliver 50 helicopters by the year 2017, Helibras as a company has more than doubled in recent years. As Francois Arnaud, Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Helibras, explains.
And the growth of the company has been absolutely tremendous. 3 years ago, we were employing 250 people here in Brazil. We are now, as we speak, we are employing more than 680 people, and we are going towards 1,000 employees towards the year 2014-2015. So the growth is particularly impressive.
And Helibras has its ambitions set even higher. By the year 2020, it plans to produce the first 100% Brazilian-produced helicopter, where all the parts and technology would come from the domestic market. Currently, Helibras' Brazilian-built aircraft are built with only 43% Brazilian parts and technology. That would mean no more need for imports, a faster way to keep up with the rapidly growing Brazilian demand for helicopters, says Mr. Arnaud.
But it's not enough. We need to build even more, to gain even more technology for our company, and we are going to do it. The president of Eurocopter, Lutz Bertling, said 2 years ago that Helibras would be the fourth pillar of Eurocopter. After Eurocopter France, Germany and Spain, Brazil will be the fourth country as the pillar, as the base for Eurocopter. And indeed, our objective, our purpose, is to build jointly with Eurocopter Brazilian aircraft by the Horizon 2020.
But some people are skeptical of Helibras' ambitious project, like Edson Perdoso, commercial director at a privately owned heliport, Helicidade.
I don't believe this. I think it's very difficult to happen. We don't have the high technology to do this. We need import some of our technologies, but I don't believe this. I believe that we continue have other majors import your components and assemble the helicopters here. But 100% made it here, I don't believe.
But others who work in the sector, like Rodrigo Duarte, are confident that Helibras will be able to produce a helicopter with all the technology and materials coming from Brazil.
We have a lot of engineers, we have a lot of industries that are ready to respond to this new demand that we have in our industry. And this is a very impressive project. I could see it a few weeks ago, and I think it will be a very good project and possible to do.
And he makes the point that producing helicopters without importing parts would give Brazil more clout as an emerging global economy.
Most important reason for that is to show to the world that Brazil can develop a new helicopter, can support parts for this helicopter, and we can have a faster way to have our demands, our local demands here in Brazil, solved faster than importing some parts from another country.
Regardless if Helibras will be able to build its Brazilian-built helicopter or not, as Sao Paulo's traffic congestion continues to worsen with more middle-class Brazilians fueling growth in the car market, Brazilian top executives will only propel the demand for more private heliports and aircraft to avoid gridlock down below. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
And let's keep things in Brazil here on Midori House. This is See You with Kamadi.
Ponta de lança. As peças se amua.
That was Kimadi by Sayu. Just. Unsuspecting tourists trekking along the footpaths of Königsleiten in Austria may now be able to get a lesson in that most audible of alpine traditions, the yodel. This is all thanks to local yodeling expert and hotel owner Christian Eder. Christian and his yodeling pals recorded themselves and set up speakers for hikers to listen and practice their craft. A little earlier, Danny Giacopelli asked Christian about the project.
The thing we're talking about is actually the yodel walk or the yodel trail. We build a yodel trail with different stations where you can listen to the yodels and sing along. And the idea behind it was that everyone can yodel, and we love singing in the mountains, and to all the visitors and also to people from the region, we wanted them to bring them back to singing, actually, to yodel. And we think the yodel is quite a good thing to start again, to sing or discover your voice again.
So how does this actually work? You press a button and you hear yodeling.
Yeah, that's how it works, actually. I think it's a little bit more sophisticated. We build, of course, it's a big cow's bell where you can walk in, and in it you find an instrument where you can play the yodel with the little cowbells. And first button is that you hear the whole yodel and you can listen to it, and then you can hear the first and second voice, and then you try out which one fits you better and try to sing along.
Can we have a little taste of what one might hear if they do this?
Yeah, of course you can. Well, actually, it's always two people singing. What about if you sing with me, Daniel?
Maybe our listeners can sing along as you do this in their homes. Okay, how about that?
The lyrics are pretty easy. I just tell you the lyrics. They don't mean nothing. It's just actually nonsense. go like this. Hopstul jo he tri hai hopstul jo he ho. And then it sounds like this.
Hopstul jo he tri hai hopstul jo he ho. Hopstul jo he tri hai hopstul jo he ho. And it goes on and on.
Amazing. And where can we find this? Where can people go to find these?
Well, the Yodel Trail is located. The village is called Königsleiten. It's up on the mountain, and it's between the province of Salzburg and the Tyrol.
Daniel Giacopelli has been yodeling in the office all afternoon since he did that interview. That's all for this edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Yodel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Studio manager was Ben Jay. Urbanist is next after the news. Emma Nelson and Hugo MacDonald are here with the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours London time. But for now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.